Hey there, everybody. It is John Casey along with Sean Johnson. I'm taking over Sean's usual role of introducing our guest today because Stephen Graham is a client of mine and also a good friend. Stephen and his senior leadership team have been in 7 or 8 two-logical programs over the last 6 years, most of which I have facilitated. We've been working with his company, Baker Hughes, since 2006 and have helped them develop thousands of leaders around the world. Ever since I met Stephen many years ago, I've considered him to be a Renaissance man. He's traveled the world. He's a great storyteller. He's a trained engineer, which means, of course, he knows how to build stuff and fix stuff. And he knows how to engage people, put them at ease, and bring out the best in them. He also happens to be a world-class business executive who runs a very large global organization for the energy giant. His professional bona fides are, he is the senior director of the global supply chain and manufacturing. He manages 8 manufacturing plants around the world and the supply chain that connects them. He leads 1,600 employees. He supports and delivers $1.7 billion in revenue. And here's a recent accomplishment. Baker Hughes Completions and Well Interventions Manufacturing is now the clear number one global leader in their space, ahead of Halliburton, Schlumberger, and Weatherford. I know you will enjoy the conversation Sean and I had with Stephen. So here is Stephen Graham.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is brought to you by Two-Logical's new virtual seminar, Adapt: How to Thrive in a World of Turbulence. Join David Naylor in this exclusive live event with leadership insights on how to effectively transition and manage your team remotely, create a new team purpose and vision for 2021, turn fear and uncertainty into consistent motivation and action, and a whole bunch more. Go to twological.com for more information on dates, and as a listener of this podcast, you get a 20% discount on tickets. Just use the code ADAPT2020 at checkout. The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is also brought to you by Mojo, the mental fitness app incubated at Two Logical. With new insights and guidance every day, people that use Mojo report feeling less stressed and more motivated, boosted performance at work, and improved well-being at home. You even get access to episodes of this podcast up to 2 weeks early on Mojo. Mojo is available through invitation only, so join the waitlist at joinmojo.com to reserve your place in line.
Okay, so for those of you who have never seen or heard Stephen, he's from Scotland. You'll certainly hear that momentarily. And he wears his hair very short. Stephen, tell us the story of why you keep your hair so short.
Never go for a beer with John. So the story goes back, I don't know, over 20 years ago, surprisingly, and I had a lot of hair back then. My wife and I were decided to go around the world for a year traveling. And one of the first stops was in Thailand. And at that point, my hair was maybe 3 or 4 inches long, styled. Laura was loving it. And then it was time to get a haircut after 2 or 3 weeks. She used to get a haircut quite regularly when you were young and your image was a big deal. I went into this hairdresser in Thailand. And then the best way to communicate, you could say hello and goodbye in Thai, and you could ask for a beer and say please and thank you. So when I went into this hairdresser's, I asked them to take maybe about quarter of an inch off, and I kind of gave that signal with your kind of thumb and index finger to say, hey, just remove 1/4 of an inch. And then within 10 seconds, the razor was on, and I thought that we're just going to start tidying up the back, but then it went straight up the back of my hair, round the front, and they were actually leaving on 1/4 of an inch as opposed to removing 1/4 of an inch. So ever since that point in time, for the rest of the travels around the world, it was a short haircut style. It was easier to maintain, and you didn't have a language barrier wherever you went because you were doing your own hair. Mm-hmm. So that's how the hairstyle was created and developed. And ever since then, it has just been a status quo.
So you backpack around the world for a year. Were you married at this time?
No, Laura and I had been together for maybe a year before that. We'd been friends for several years before that. So no, we were not married. But the good thing was, right, we stayed together for the full year, and you're with someone for 365 days for a year, 24 hours a day, it may be longer than some people spend together in their whole marriage. So we were able to survive that. So by the time we came back, it was an easy decision on both sides. It wasn't really a decision. It just kind of became natural after that. So
after that, you're pretty much prepared for anything.
Yes. Yeah. We'd been through a lot and seen a lot of each other, believe me, in many different circumstances. So no, it was
for couples, I think, to maybe go on a walkabout to see if you're actually meant to be together.
How you travel together.
So Stephen, tell us a little bit about, you know, what did you learn about the world? What did you learn about, you know, different cultures? And what did you learn about, you know, picking a partner during that year that, you know, you look back on and you think you may have leveraged or used in your career or personal life?
I mean, we met a lot of people, different cultures, different ethnicities. And initially you start off in like a normal 2 week vacation, right? You think the first 2 weeks are fun and party, but then it starts to subside after that. And then you start to really think about why you're on this trip, right? You're on the trip to see some great sights. But Laura and I really took a lot of time to learn the culture, learn the language, really bond with the different people we were coming across, whether fellow travelers or people from those countries that we were visiting. So you really took a step back to listen to what people were saying in a different language and in a different culture and from a perspective you'd never understood before. And you start to really appreciate how much people have to say and how that can really improve your viewpoint on the world and on other people, right? I mean, I was quite young and determined prior to traveling, thought I had all the answers. And then you started to be really humbled by a lot of the insights and even the challenges other people had or how other people were living. I mean, we were going through some areas in Thailand, et cetera, and in Vietnam were really some of the families that they didn't have a lot. They had each other. They ate very simply, lived simply, but they were so happy, had a smile on their face every day. And you really started to appreciate the humble way they approach life and the simple things that makes them happy. And then just their thought process on how to go after that day in a positive way. And I think a lot of that positivity and influences did help me in my life. And again, you start to also how you can communicate and touch other people where historically you were living on a small island in the UK. We used to maybe travel to Europe, which is very, very similar in the lifestyle, etc., a different language. But you start going to the Far East, you start going further afield, then you start to have to use different techniques in how to communicate, right? And how you need to bond relationships through conversations that maybe you're not speaking the same language, but you start to have to use your body language just as much, your appearance just as much as the words you say. And it definitely rounded me off in that aspect. And then you were on your own, right? Laura and I, we saved up some money before we went. There's no other opportunity. We had to do a bit of work as well. And you were traveling from place to place, finding your own accommodation nearly every 3 or 4 days, having to negotiate price on that accommodation. So we definitely learned a lot of life experiences that helped me, obviously from a personal standpoint and relationship standpoint, but definitely flowed into my career and really transponded me into more of a communicator and very culture aware on how to build trust and how to have communication and how to really look for the best in people and how to bring that out as well.
Wow. So, you know, it's safe to say then this 1 year education helped you in your business career. You run a global organization with 1,600 employees around the world. So, you know, that education, even though it wasn't formal, has to have helped you in your career, you know, for these last 20 years.
Yeah, without any doubt. I don't think I would be where I am today without having that experience, both personally and professionally.
Yeah, you know, in the small amount of traveling, I certainly haven't done a year around the world, but, you know, doing the small amount of traveling that I have done, that a few things struck me as the same as you. It was amazing to me how much communication is nonverbal, you know, when you don't speak the same language as somebody, and yet you can kind of figure out what it is that they're saying or trying to say. That was always amazing to me it was really eye-opening in the process. And you kind of think like, well, hey, if I can figure out how to, you know, get from point A to point B and, you know, find a hotel and negotiate the price with a bunch of people that I don't speak the language with, I could pretty much figure out anything.
Yeah. And the first or second time, I mean, it became a habit, right? Cause we were staying in backpacking places and dormitories and you name it. And within every 2 days, you're then jumping up. I mean, we went up the coast of Vietnam and you're stopping off every 3 days, and you would jump out of a bus, and you would, even within that, you'd go along a street of four or five hostels and look at the room, negotiate the best price and say, well, I'll be back in 2 minutes, and then continue that on until you found a place to stay. And Laura would be sitting outside with the backpacks, and she's like, here he goes again. You enjoy this. I'm like, no, I'm trying to find the best accommodation for you.
Well, that's supply chain and the manufacturing training, I think.
So. Yeah, there you go.
So Stephen, tell me about, you know, after this trip around the world, I'd love to just kind of hear broad stroke about your career journey. How did you get started at Baker?
So yeah, that went back, I think I joined Baker in 1992, obviously started when I was four. But prior to that, the engineering mechanical side came from my mom's dad, my granddad, who... he worked for the National Engineering Laboratory in the UK. He got an MBE for engineering services, and then the Queen gave him a medal for his service in engineering. So that kind of gave me a little inspiration around the engineering side. And his family used to own like a watchmaker's in Glasgow, and they had a little machine shop underneath the house. And I used to go there in my summer days when I was 13 and 14. My mom and dad would drop me off in Glasgow and leave me there all day, and I would tinker around with him and his brother, jumping on a lathe here and there and kind of cleaning up old gauges. And so the mechanical side came from that. I mean, all my friends were bumming around in summer, and I was in an old machine shop with my granddad all day and drinking cups of tea. The bell would go, and my great aunt upstairs would be making cups of tea, and then you'd go up the stairs and have a sandwich and tea and back down to the machine shop after that. And you think, yeah, why are you doing that? You should be out. And don't get me wrong, there would be days when you're out playing, but I think that went a long way to the kind of interest in the mechanical side. And basically this was just a job that came up for an apprenticeship. And school-wise, I enjoyed the social aspect of school, but the study aspect and going into university, I think some of the things I'd picked up as a kid, I was more of a get-going guy, out there, get hands-on stuff, creative. So the apprenticeship side was really a big draw for me to go into that rather than go through university. So got the job, and then started a four-year mechanical apprenticeship with Baker, and then worked my way up from there.
Yeah, so I'd love to, you know, the next question I wanted to ask was about some mentors you had along the way, but it sounds like maybe the first one that you had was actually your grandpa. What did you learn from just, you know, being in his shop and watching him tinker and watching him work?
He was very meticulous. I mean, you're dealing with watchmaking here. He used to machine gold for the National Engineering Laboratory. And this was even after he was retired. They would still send him small bits of gold to machine. So just watching him save those, and this is very small stuff, quarter inch in diameter and maybe half an inch long, and he's putting holes in these things. And just watching him be very, he was very meticulous, took his time, kept the place very clean and tidy. And those kind of traits did pay off when I started my apprenticeship, and just taking care of what you're doing came through, and just being, he used to stay on the job until the job was done as well. It wouldn't be, yeah, the bells weren't let's go. It would be let's get the job done and then let's leave when we're finished. So that kind of trait as well. But I mean, I go back to my parents who were big, as always, big fans in your life. Never, they would make sure you never took a day off school. You'd wake up and if you don't feel well, get to school, you're fine. And that has stayed with me as well through my professional career.
Yeah, definitely. And how about once you got to Baker, did you have, you know, who are some people maybe that have guided you or mentored you along the way throughout your career at Baker? Anybody in particular come to mind?
I mean, my first boss, definitely. He really showed a lot of care. Very quiet gentleman, but he showed a lot of care about my success. I was one of the, I think I was the first apprentice, and it was a Baker had bought that company 15 years ago. I was the first apprentice within 15 years at that location. And he really took me under his wing like one of his family and really showed a lot of care for the success and really invested in training and gave me every opportunity. So that was definitely one aspect of care that I picked up that when you see someone that, or if you show care and consideration for someone, then they'll go all in and reciprocate that. So he was definitely one. I mean, I think along the way, there's been many smaller influences, where you'd say rather than mentors, small influences, on you would either pick up a badge or you would see what would not work and make sure you'd done the reverse of that. And then there was other areas. Dan Richardson used to really do a good job of motivating people with some positive words and look for the best in people. So I definitely got that from him. So yeah, there's been many, and even today, my current boss is really how to rather than wait for the wind to blow the ship in a different direction, you need to go ahead and change the sail, right? The direction of the sail, as opposed to wait for the wind to do it. So how do you really, if something isn't going well, make a change as hard as it may be that is going to benefit the outcome?
Well, yeah, and most important to your industry, the ups and downs of the oil and gas business. So let me take you back. I think it was 2012. You know, you're in the manufacturing and supply chain space for Baker Hughes. And in 2012, Halliburton was number one in that space. And that was a title that Baker Hughes used to have. And I think it was you and your team that really put a singular focus on getting back to being number one. And I think you even said it was going to take about 5 years or so. And now you're there. So tell us a little bit about that vision and that journey. You know, how did you get the team to buy in? Did they think it was possible? Did they have to overcome some challenges? And what was that journey like now that you're looking in the rearview mirror and that you are, in fact, number one in your space?
So, yeah, the journey for number one, yeah, came around about 2016, 17, where, yeah, the deal with Halliburton that we were working through didn't come off, which was a highlight for everyone. I think as we exited that, then for completions and well intervention, we were number two. We were number one. I mean, we invented liner hangers, right? And liner hangers, we still own 42% market share within liner hanger space, but we've been number one in many of the product lines. But then Halliburton started to overtake. There's other smaller companies out there starting to be competitive. So around about 2016, we made a stand to 17 to be the clear number one within our product line. And there was three elements to that. I mean, it was around about customer focus and trusted, service quality, well, deliver with service execution. And then I think it was all about making sure that we understand the actions to get there, right? What's it going to take to get there? How do we rally the organization? How do we make it clear for people to understand how they play a part in it? And it was essentially a five-year journey from 17 to get there. And as you say, John, as we exited 2019, nearly 2 years earlier than anticipated, based on Spears and Rystad's reports, we are 3 points clear of the competition. And again, that's obviously based on top-line growth. But it was a a huge testament to the whole organization. And again, we've had many elements within the business, because we've got the guys out in the geomarkets, the sales teams, we've got the guys at the wellheads on the rig floor, we've got people in our AMO shops. You then tie that back all the way to the supply chain, the manufacturing team, and then tie it back upstream of that, where you've got the product line and you've got the engineering teams. And this vision really tied everyone together just to be the clear number one. I mean, always be customer focused and trusted. It's in front of the external customer, and we tied it to supply chain for the internal customer. And then innovate and deliver with speed. Again, innovate comes from engineering. Innovation comes from within supply chain. How do we make things faster, better, easier and cheaper? And then deliver with speed as well. Again, tying it through product line engineering and supply chain. How do we get the product there quicker than the competition and be reliable with that, right? And then differentiate with service execution. That ties all the way from engineering with a reliable design, the supply chain from making the equipment to spec that it works, and then to the team executing on the rig floor, doing that flawlessly, right? We see now that those three key elements and three pillars, if you focus on three simple things and kind of take that within the organization and tie it to how people can impact it, those are three big levers that we've been able to use in our favor, and we've seen the benefit with being rewarded time after time. I mean, the customer says you've got the best technology, and now we trust when you're going to deliver, and then your service execution. We used to have like 92% of NPT. Or 8% of NPT, we're now down to 1%, less than 1% of non-productive time on the rig, right? So just focusing on the whole organization on that service execution piece, when we show up with the right equipment at the right time and it runs perfectly and flawlessly on 99% of the time, which is a huge accomplishment, then the customer keeps coming back. And I was always tied back to the supply chain teams where if you buy a car and you take it back home, and on the way home, it breaks down, you'll take it back to the dealership and they'll maybe give you a replacement or fix it there and then you'll drive back. And then if the car breaks down a second time, you're taking that car back and you're leaving it and you're going to another company. So we better make sure we get it right first time. If we don't get it right first time, we better make sure it's quick and recovered in a reliable way to keep the customers coming back. So I think those three pillars in focusing the whole organization on those three pillars allowed us to kind of beat our goal by 2 years, and now we're in a space of a new legacy, right, of being back to the clear number one.
Wow, that type of success doesn't happen by accident, and it doesn't happen without some big strategic moves. You know, in business, often the best defense is a great offense. You made some strategic moves that were maybe ahead of the curve. You know, for example, moving more and more manufacturing to the Eastern Hemisphere, where the demand was growing and a lot of the reserves were. So speak to some of the strategic moves that you did while using those three cultural pillars, if you will, to guide the team. But then you made some other big, you know, strategic business moves. So tell us a little bit about that. And, you know, frankly, they may have been risky at the time. Now looking back in hindsight, when they were ahead of time and ideal moves. So speak to some of those strategic moves that you and the team made in order to help you get to that number one sooner.
Within the supply chain space, back in, again, 2014, 2015, we were going through, or 2015 and 2016 as well, we were going through a downturn, right? So when you go through a downturn within supply chain, you're always looking at how do we try and optimize the fixed cost that we carry, right? If activity goes down, we always carry a certain level of fixed cost. How do we try and streamline that and make sure we don't break it for the upturn, because it's the joyful oil and gas industry that when it does go down, it comes back up. And no one has a crystal ball about when it's going to happen, because there's many elements that play into that, as everyone knows. Geopolitical, economical, etc. So So we, in that time in 2016, we started putting plans together, and I'd taken over the global team by then. So we started to look at our overall network, our infrastructure, and start to create what should, if the future is going to be an incremental 5 or 10 or 15 or 20% up from where we are, which was kind of, at that point, we thought was the bottom. Then what are we going to need in place and where are we going to need it? And at that point, we could clearly see the historical way of doing business was supply the world from the Western Hemisphere, right? Because all the technology was developed in the Western Hemisphere, the Houston area, in Oklahoma, and in that kind of central North America area was where all the technology started. So traditionally, that's where it was supplied from. But we could start to see that the demand was growing in the East. And at that point, it was only maybe 35 or maybe 40% of the demand was in the East. And when you could see during that down cycle, the volatility in North America was evident. So we started to look at how can we expand the capability in the Eastern Hemisphere, and where should we do it, and where do we need to invest, and then how do we build the capability as well. So we started on a four-year journey. It was not, again, that was another five-year journey, which we finished off a big part of that last year, so maybe a year or two ahead, and we're just completing Houston consolidation just now, which again, we pulled that forward another year. And now we have maybe about 70% of our demand is in the East. And historically, we would only support maybe 30 to 35% from the East. As of today, we are supplying 50% of our supply is coming from the East. So nearly 85% of the needed supply in the East is coming from our Eastern Hemisphere locations. And John, you and I spoke about this. I think as you look at some of the circumstances we're going through today with the pandemic, having our supply chains closer to our customer has allowed us to evade some of the logistical challenges we're going through right now, some of the border closures we're going through right now, by creating a supply chain around some of our Eastern Hemisphere hubs, which gives you the agility, gives you the speed, and gives you the connection point, and also standardize what you're doing in that location for that location. The internal customer as well within the product line, them being tied to that location very closely. And we're supporting locally now 60 to 70% of the demand from a local area in each of our seven geo markets. So I think when you look back then, there was a lot of putting things on a PowerPoint presentation that all looked good and well. And sometimes when it came down to the crunch, these things would get delayed. But I think with the passion, the courage of the team, we've actually been able to pull some of this forward and just take a leap of faith. But it's been all in from many elements within the product line, support from the product line itself, the engineering teams, to build up in the procurement team, supplier quality, to build up capability in the East and really step out of our comfort zone to make this a success. And we're starting to, and as we came into this year, the benefits were astronomical from having those localized supply chains already up and running and already established.
Wow. You know, well, first of all, oil and gas industry is dangerous. Manufacturing, all manufacturing, there's opportunities for incidents. Supply chain, same thing. So, you know, it's a tough business. It's a dangerous business often. So over the last few years, you've developed these three cultural pillars. You've made some of these strategic global moves, and you've done it while maintaining such a stellar HS&E record. Was there also a focus on that, and is that woven into the culture? Because making all those kind of moves in such an industry, while maintaining that health, safety, and environmental record, you know, it didn't happen by accident, did it?
No. I think ever since, so I'll go back to my apprenticeship again when I was four. I remember we used to drill 30-foot long solid bits of metal, maybe 12-inch diameter, and we used to drill holes in these big long bars. And I remember standing on top of an oily drilling machine with this, I think it was maybe a 60-pound head, as an apprentice trying to twist this head onto a pipe to start drilling a bar. And I remember the head slipped and I tried to grab it with my hand, and it cut my thumb. So ever since that point, it really changed my risk tolerance and importance around safety. And how some people are not really aware of the hazards, and then the importance of driving a culture of that awareness for themselves and people around them. So ever since that day, safety became a really, we say today, it used to be a priority, but it's a way of doing business, right? We need to be doing everything possible to keep ourselves safe and our people safe, and really drive that interdependent culture. So within Baker Hughes, it has been a huge drive, and we were leading the industry as Baker Hughes before we merged with GE as the number one HS&E culture, HS&E performance within all of the OFS companies in our segment. So we really took that to heart and really drove HS&E deep within the organization. Every meeting starts with HS&E, a safety moment. We have stop work cards, and we really empower our teams on the floor to lead in safety. We talk about safety leadership. Everyone should be a leader in safety. But within supply chain, so the taking all that into consideration and how I really had that safety culture ingrained in me, I made sure that any communication and strategy that we had within supply chain, I would also always talk to safety and make sure that safety comes at no cost to anything else. I don't want to see a tool going out the door on time at the right cost, but someone get injured. And try and make it clear. I used to do in town halls all the time, make it clear about why is that important, right? It's important because so you go home to your family the same way you came to work, right? We don't want anyone's family feeling hurt or feeling sad because whoever within our four walls injured themselves in a bad way that it changes their life. So really making sure and having that in the forefront of everyone's mind in every conversation, every startup, and focusing on the thoughts and beliefs around safety and get people thinking that way as opposed to it's a metric, allowed us to achieve our best year ever in perfect days. We measure the business by how many HS&E perfect days we had. And we had 363 in 2019, which is our best ever record. And we used to have maybe 10 non-perfect days or 12 non-perfect days a year. We only had 2 non-perfect days, even with an increase in activity. And we hired 8% more people as well. We reduced that from 12 to 2 and had our best year ever in 2019.
Yeah, but it sounds you tapped into such a powerful motivator there when it comes to safety. You know, what's going to motivate people more than just thinking about remembering that it's their job to, you know, bring themselves and their coworkers back home to their families safe and sound. Can't imagine there's a better thing to keep top of mind to ensure everybody's being safe. So, Stephen, now that Baker has achieved that number one spot, what's the vision? What's the mission moving forward?
Obviously, staying clear number one is the mission, but staying clear number one with incremental profitability is the path we're on now. So being clear number one in revenue and all of that is good, but you need to follow through with a strong cash and profitability position. So it's how do we yield the same number one spot, but do it in a more profitable way in how we operate, how we engage with the customer. We want to bring value to them as much as to us. So it's really improving our value proposition to the shareholder is the next step in the journey of CWI.
Yeah. So, you know, I want to go back real quick to, you know, the strategic move that you made to move manufacturing to the Eastern Hemisphere. One thing I'm sure that you're focused on in terms of profitability is innovation. So, you know, how do it, maybe even deconstructing, how did you spot that opportunity to move manufacturing over to the Eastern Hemisphere? And how do you plan on having the team, you know, spot similar opportunities moving forward?
So how we continue to drive that is really changing and getting all the brains in the game in our organization on a daily basis. I mean, this year we started on a new mission around value creation, right? We don't want to be talking about low cost or cost out or all those things. Within supply chain, you create value by being efficient at what you do. Because every dollar we can save in supply chain is a dollar of profit. So we really started that drive this year and around how did every brain in the game in supply chain create value every day, whether they're raising a PO or they're running a machine or they're building a tool in assembly or they're inspecting a part or how they're planning a job and planning. You're creating a router and methods. Everyone has the opportunity to create value. You can put value into the organization by being able to bring more efficiency to every action that you take during that day.
So, Stephen, you mentioned it a couple times, get every brain in the game. How do you draw out other people's ideas about increasing efficiency in value creation?
So we've established trying to create that culture of execution, right, and get everyone's brain in the game. We're using a system, a 4DX system, and it's now all around value creation. And that goes all the way down in the organization, all the way down from the plant leaders to their management and their management to their supervisors and the supervisors down to the employees on the floor. And we now have systems in place where we have an August system where we have that daily visibility of their wildly important goal on the floor. How did they do yesterday? Did they have a good day? And if they did have a good day, great, let's replicate or let's improve. Or if they didn't, what different action do we need to take today to get back on track? So really tying in everyone's outputs and actions in that day to that scoreboard and the OGO system, and then that ties up to a bigger and broader plant value creation goal, and then that drives up to a global value creation goal as well. So just creating that cadence of accountability on the floor with everyone. Don't get me wrong, it's still a daily communication point and touch point. But for me, it's about continuing to create those why leaders on the floor. So explaining why it's important and why what we do today is going to make an impact is how we get all those brains in the game. So we have really over the last 3 years used and implemented some of these systems and tools and focus on that one wildly important thing on a daily basis to make sure we accomplish something that we know adds value, and it kind of flows all the way up to the broader spectrum and the broader goal, and people can feel part of it.
Well, here's a question I've been dying to ask. The oil and gas business is legendary for its volatility, and the fast ups and downs are not for the faint of heart. How do you prepare your people for that volatility, for that craziness?
To go back to Winston Churchill, similar accent, right? A pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity, and an optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. I think, and I've used that quite often, he always sticks with me, that guy. But I think it's looking for the opportunity when things don't appear to be going the way we want it to go, right? Even in the times of today, I mean, we're finding new and creative ways to do things during pandemics when a lot of people are working from home. But just creating that mindset within our leadership team of a challenge is an opportunity to grow, right? And for, again, I can't speak for everyone in our organization, but it's up to me to prepare the leaders who are front and center of those organizations to have that mindset, right? To have the ability to motivate when the oil price is going down, or try and have the team focus on what they can impact for that day is the key to continuing to keep the mind on the task in hand and to do it with the best of their ability and to find better ways to do it every single day, even when the market economics are bad and the times. I think sometimes in supply chain, we are somewhat sheltered from that immediate drop in oil price. So I think it's a bit easier on the supply chain side of the business to keep that motivation and momentum going and that focus on what you can control.
Right. Wow. All right. So I got a little research here, Stephen, I want to ask you about. I got, took a look at your corporate profile page. You summarize your career journey in four words: culture, trust, strategy, and execution. So, two-part question. Why those words? And is there any significance that they are in that order?
You should be able to ask that question.
Well, one of your colleagues sent me a piece of paper with some of this information on it. But, you know, it really resonated with me, those four words: culture, trust, strategy, and execution. Are they in any particular order? Does that make sense? Are they logistical that way?
I think they are. Yeah, they are in some kind of order, but they kind of all flow into each other at any given point. But what I've learned and what I've seen, and John, you and I speak about this all the time, about culture, eat strategy for breakfast. If you don't start, and you don't have the right culture from the word go, right? That if someone comes across that one day, man, they're either lucky or they've done a lot of investigation before they start in that company. So in culture, dynamics change with the times as well, right? But I think there's core culture elements that need to be in place for any team to be successful. And that starts with the leader, and then it goes all the way through the organization. And having the right culture is all about, obviously, having the right mindset and thoughts and beliefs and all those things, John, that you've really ingrained in me through the years. And I think those repetitions of the benefits of having the right culture keep coming up. And again, it goes back to the daily language you have with yourself, the daily language you have with your family, and then that you have with your team before you enter, or yourself in the car before you enter the office, and then when you enter the office, and having that language around where are we, what can we do, how are you doing, showing some care, building the trust, do they understand the strategy, and are you giving them the tools to be able to execute? So I think that's all of that kind of flows through, and it is in somewhat that order, but they keep kind of interlinking back to each other to say, do we have the right trust for people to execute on the strategy, right? So I think they're very strong words, but I think as I've went through my career, you kind of start from the back, right? You start being good at execution, right, of your own task in hand, right? And then you then start to link as I went through my career, okay, what's the strategy for me now in this supervisory role, right? What do we want to achieve and can we execute? And then as I went through my career and grew and developed, and then you start to really understand that people being able to, if they don't understand the goal or they don't believe in you, then they ain't going to execute, right? So then how do you go up front of that and really have people believe on their own through their own language, which is really developing the right culture for them to be walking into the plant that day or the office that day with all the right thoughts and beliefs on how they're going to, what they're going to do, how they're going to achieve things, and how they're motivated to push themselves with self-confidence, etc., is the kind of end piece in the culture element.
Right. Well, it's just refreshing to see that in your career journey, you know, people would maybe focus on accomplishments or, you know, profit or things like that. But, you know, culture, trust, strategy, and execution have much more depth. And I really do like the order, because if you do not have a good culture, a leader will not receive the trust of the team, and they will not buy into the strategy, and they will not execute. So yeah, it's almost like a four-step way to get to the results. So I found that incredibly wise and evolved.
Again, I'm going to get the guy that gave you that.
Yeah.
So Stephen, you know, before we wrap up, I actually want to circle back around. You know, we kind of touched on your career journey throughout this conversation and a bit more at the end here, but it really has been a pretty incredible career journey to, you know, you're somebody that went from an apprentice in the organization to now leading a global team of 1,600 people. What advice would you give to somebody, maybe somebody that's listening to this, that would want to have achieve a similar career path and career trajectory?
I mean, you can't get there without the team, right? You need to invest in the people as much as your expertise and what you do and your drive to achieve results, right? Kind of John said it as well. If you focus on the results, then you're going to miss the bigger elements of what success you can bring. And really, really look at, obviously, today, if someone's in the organization and they're just stepping in and they're looking for a trajectory straight up, don't go too fast, right? If you go too fast, then you can fall fast. I think building up the understanding of the individuals or what it takes to kind of motivate people, you need to be unselfish, right? And again, I think when you're young and you're career driven, you want to make sure you stand out from the crowd and you get the praise you deserve. And all those things and thoughts are not wrong, but sometimes it could prevent you from really capturing the essence of what a successful team looks like. And people will promote you based on results, but they'll also promote you based on how you achieve those results. So listen and learn is a simple thing. Make sure that you approach people in a way that you're genuine and you're there. If you're a leader or a young manager, you need to really instill the trust in the team that they believe that you're there to help them, right? And if they understand that you're there to help them, then they will reciprocate and help you in your career journey as well. Mm-hmm. And also, and I've had many career conversations with people, make sure you've got an idea of where you want to go and set a timeline to that, right? You might never end up at that location, but if you don't set yourself a target of the role you would like to be in, and it may be a role that you know someone's in or a role that is within another organization that you see would benefit this organization, take a look at what those levels of expertise and training and knowledge is required and start building and working your way towards building up those knowledge and expertise gaps that you may have. So you're prepared for taking that next step in that next role. But if you don't have your mind set on a goal of a role and a timeline to get there, then it won't drive the right action today or tomorrow, right? It can always be open-ended. And I'm always assertive on setting the timeline for anything we do, but really for your own personal development, you need to be learning 3 or 4 things by the end of this year, right? But those 3 or 4 things need to be aligned to the knowledge gaps that you may have to take you up the ladder to that role that you're shooting for, that you're aiming for. And again, it may not be that role that you end up at, but at least you're building up core competencies and knowledge that is something that you don't have today, but leading you to that bigger role in front of you. But make sure it's known and time-bound.
Yeah, that's great advice. Jeez, John, he's good at this.
Yeah, he travels around the world.
John's trained me well.
Well, both Stephen, you and I, you know, we have no pride of authorship. And if it's a great idea, it doesn't matter where it comes from. We may not be smart enough to actually invent the idea, but we're smart enough to go find it and maybe synthesize it a little bit. One last question. If there's one thing you would like your team or Baker Hughes as an organization to take away from this conversation, what is it?
Believe in yourself and believe in your teams around you. I mean, the language we use with each other is powerful, and it needs to be done in a very supportive and proactive way. I think as we go through our journey in 2020 and beyond in the next 1, 2, 3 years, it's care and cash are king, right? I think making sure that we continue with the showing care for our families, keeping them safe and well, obviously through these challenging times we're going through is important, but showing care to our teams, provide them with support to grow, allow them the ability to try new things as well, take care of each other from an HS&E standpoint. Again, at no cost will we harm anyone, or the business is not successful if people get injured. So care is definitely something we keep in the forefront of our daily beliefs. And then knowing why it's important around profitability and cash. I mean, the teams that are 6 inches from the action, they know they've got the biggest impact, right? They know more about cause and effect than anyone. And it's important that our teams that are 6 inches from the action and making the magic happen understand how they impact the profitability and why it's important when we improve the profitability of the company, and then make sure they're getting recognized for it as well. So promoting them to do more of the same and motivate them to continue on that path, because the right culture and developing our team and making sure the goals are understood and everyone knows how they can impact them is the key to success for everyone, right? We want everyone to be successful. I mean, I'm here only to make my team successful and for them to be happy in what they do and recognize them and guide them every day. And I want the same for every leader, manager, supervisor to be replicating the same and everyone feel part of the game and then know how they can change the game and impact the game as well. But care and cash are two big things over the next 1, 2, 3 years that we want our teams to be really keeping in the forefront of their mindset, right, as they come in and even as they go home to their families. But very, very, very proud of the supply chain team that I've been leading for the last 4 years. I think how connecting with everyone, I feel very, very positive about the mindset. I feel very inspired by a lot of the actions people are taking on their own accord. And I'm here to serve them. And that's kind of the big message. I'm here for them to be successful.
Wow, that's a great lesson for all leaders. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time, Stephen. This was great. It was a great conversation.
Well, thank you, guys. Appreciate the opportunity. And as always, John, your insights and touch points and biannual training sessions are the highlight of my year. Looking forward to touching base with you again in a few weeks.
All right, my friend. Thanks again.
Good stuff.
Best is yet to come, buddy.
Yeah. Well, you guys stay safe and well, and I really appreciate your time.
Yep. Thank you, Stephen.
Take care, Stephen.
The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is brought to you by Two Logical's new virtual seminar, Adapt: How to Thrive in a World of Turbulence. Join David Naylor in this exclusive live event with leadership insights on how to effectively transition and manage your team remotely, create a new team purpose and vision for 2021, turn fear and uncertainty into consistent motivation and action, and a whole bunch more. Go to twological.com for more information on dates. And as a listener of this podcast, you get a 20% discount on tickets. Just use the code ADAPT2020 at checkout. The Motivational Intelligence Podcast is also brought to you by Mojo, the mental fitness app incubated at Two Logical. With new insights and guidance every day, people that use Mojo report feeling less stressed and more motivated, boosted performance at work, and improved well-being at home. You even get access to episodes of this podcast up to 2 weeks early on Mojo. Mojo is available through invitation only, so join the waitlist at joinmojo.com to reserve your place in line.